You know how important it is to ensure that your supplements are genuine, safe, and effective. That's why I partnered with Fullscript, an online dispensing platform that only offers curated professional-grade brands I know and trust, the very same supplements that I prescribe to my patients and take myself. Never counterfeit or expired, always stored and shipped correctly. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to start your free Fullscript account. Buying through Fullscript offers fast shipping, optional refill reminders, a mobile-friendly site. It's safe, secure, and HIPAA-compliant and offers world-class support. Fullscript also gives you access to my custom-targeted supplement protocols that combine the products that I recommend to address specific needs, heart health, immune support, and much more. Just go to DearHoffmanStore.com to sign up for your free Fullscript account. You'll get access to the supplements and features you need to help you achieve your wellness goals. That's DearHoffmanStore.com. DearHoffmanStore.com. Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Today, I'm with Layla Mutin because it's our weekly Q&A with Layla. We do this once a week where we answer your questions. Questions at drhoffman.net is the place to go for answers. And we've got questions. So, Layla, fire away.
We've got an email from Matt. Dear Dr. Hoffman, my cholesterol is like 200 and my A1C is 6.7. Can we lower this the holistic way?
Okay, well, let's focus on the hemoglobin A1C.
Yeah.
The hemoglobin A1C is a measure of your blood sugar over time. It is looking at the hemoglobin, which is a protein.
Yeah.
And the extent to which sugar has damaged it or rusted it or glycosylated it. Hence, yeah. It's called a glycosylated hemoglobin. And it's a nice, kind of a handy way to measure your blood sugar control. Mm-hmm. And the norms are that if it is above 6.2 or 6.4, you're diabetic. If you are below 6.2 to 5.8, you're a little bit in the intermediate zone, pre-metabolic syndrome, that kind of thing. And then 5.6 or less is ideal. We'd really like to get it down to 5 and change or even like 4.8.
Yeah.
Mine's 4.8 last time I checked.
Oh, yeah. Cool.
So that I'm lucky. That
5.2. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. But, sure. You know, it's not entirely a merit system. There are metabolic mm-hmm. factors involved, mm-hmm. but exercise and diet will help to normalize it. So the best way, par excellence, well, you discuss it.
Yeah, I mean, 6.7 A1C is clearly in the diabetic range. Matt, the very, very good news is this is absolutely a lifestyle choice, and that means you can reverse it. So what type 2 diabetes is, which is what we're talking about here with this A1C, is a condition of carbohydrate intolerance, mm-hmm. aka glucose intolerance. So the antidote is a low carb diet.
Yep.
So your body can manage the carbohydrates, hence the blood sugar much better. You can quite easily lower this A1C.
Right.
Within a 3 to 5 month period on a very low carb ketogenic diet. It can happen.
Yeah.
If you do all the right things. Unless there are other reasons.
I might suggest that you go listen to my podcast with
Gary Taubes
about rethinking diabetes.
Yes.
Now, here's just one fly in the ointment here is we will sometimes see some people who have elevated blood sugar, adults, who are thin.
Yeah.
And we
have to be overweight.
But yeah. They'll be thin and they won't respond as well because they've already started to resemble type 1 diabetics.
Yes.
And
it's like a late stage type 2 diabetes where the pancreas is worn out, is not secreting so much insulin anymore after doing it over and over for decades and decades and decades.
But these people need
they're becoming type 1
they
diabetics.
They may need medication or even
But not autoimmune, just...
So we don't know what he looks like. I mean, when somebody comes in and they got a big belly and, you know, it's like easy because that's what is causing the problem. But if they're thin already, sometimes it's occasionally we'll see somebody who has been an alcoholic and they kind of killed their pancreas.
Yes.
That is a scenario for blood sugar abnormalities that don't respond as well to they will get better, but they don't respond perfectly.
Yeah.
I mean, we can normalize most people. The other thing that is important is exercise, but you can't run away from a bad diet.
No, you can't. You know. You can't decide, maybe you're a marathoner, but that doesn't mean you could have a quart of ice cream every night.
And let's give some credit to resistance training and strength training with weights or resistance, because that too, it's about 50-50 for this type of problem, is that we actually want people to work on strengthening their muscles.
Yes.
And not just running, miles and miles.
Right.
Although that's good. The other thing is, especially for men, I like to look at testosterone because many overweight pre-diabetic males have low testosterone. And testosterone, A, helps to motivate them to exercise, helps to build muscle, and it energizes them so that they can burn off more calories.
But, it's that overweight status or that belly fat in particular which causes the low T.
It's a vicious cycle. It's a chicken and egg thing.
Right. And the other thing that you don't want to do, Matt, is go on a very low-calorie diet.
Right.
Because when you do that, you'll lose some fat, but you're also going to lose your muscle.
Right.
And that's your metabolic machinery. That's your metabolic engine to stoke your metabolic health. And you want to keep your lean body mass at all costs. That's why exercise.
The semaglutides, and actually,
Ozempic.
Pronunciation, I used to pronounce it semaglutides, but I hear a lot of people saying, medical people saying semaglutide. So
I've been saying semaglutide and I've been corrected to say semaglutide.
So it's like tomato kind of.
Okay. You know. Like I say autophagy instead of autophagy.
Caribbean.
Right. right.
So I don't know. Right. I'm going to say semaglutides. They will fix this hemoglobin A1C. They've been demonstrated to do that.
Yes.
That's how they got approved initially for diabetes.
Yeah.
But at the expense of reducing muscle mass, which can be deleterious ultimately.
Absolutely.
Now, I also want to talk about not just what you eat, but when you eat. Talk a little bit about that there, because there's some benefits to food timing, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. Intermittent fasting, time-restricted eating is very, very beneficial, especially those who are quite who have a lot of hyperinsulinemia. whose insulins are in the stratosphere.
Right.
The intermittent fasting end of this really, really helps to lower that insulin.
Uh-huh.
So all of us human beings walking planet Earth need to be fasting a minimum of 12 hours for autophagy to happen because it peaks at the 12th hour of fast. But going to 15, 16 hours is very, very beneficial. Or even some people will even do the time-restricted eating between a six-hour period rather than an eight-hour period.
That really improves.
Get all your... Oh. And it really can be helpful.
So another thing, for someone like this, very useful would be to get a CGM.
Yes.
If you can get your doctor
to
prescribe
one. Which is a continuous glucose monitor.
Yeah. Because you can see what the effects of certain meals would be.
Oh, yeah.
Meal timing, exercise. Mm-hmm. You get a bad night's sleep. Say you're on a flight from New York to Zurich, and the flight leaves at 10 and, you don't get much sleep. And the next day you're ravenous.
Yeah.
Lack of sleep will affect your blood sugar.
Absolutely. And it'll worsen blood sugar amongst those with diabetes, not getting a good night's sleep. Yep. And all that cortisol rushing around doesn't help either.
Yep.
So a CGM is so beneficial. I just had a patient I talked to the other day. Had an A1C of 6.1. That was back in December. It's now down to a 5.6.
Whew.
And the CGM really helped him out because he got to see firsthand, look what happened when I ate that very nutritious sweet potato.
Yeah.
Huh.
I have seen in my career people who, when initially I saw them, I said, I don't know if I can treat this person without medication, but before I prescribe anything, I'm going to try.
Mm-hmm.
And they had hemoglobin A1Cs of 10, 11, 12, which is really raging diabetes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, because, look, when I see somebody, I don't know how determined they're going to be, whether they're going to take my advice, whether they're going to run, whether they're going to be able to sustain it.
Yeah.
And some of them have been like, I'm there. I'm going to do it. And through their tenacity with my guidance, they've normalized their blood sugar.
Yeah.
It's a remarkable thing to go from like a 10 to a 5.6.
Yeah.
Can be done. Mm-hmm. And I wish doctors would have the knowledge, wherewithal, and faith.
Yeah.
That this is something that can be done and should be done as a prelude to putting people on lots of meds.
Yeah.
Now, there's a place for the meds.
True. I mean,
you can go on these semaglutides. You can go on metformin. I'm not averse to metformin. You can take something like Jardiance. Some of the other diabetes medications I'm not a big fan of.
Right.
Insulin, if you have to.
Only if you have to. It's a last resort.
And the less, the better.
Absolutely.
And there's some really nice books about it by my colleague, Dr. Dick Bernstein, Richard Bernstein.
Yes.
Who is a type 1 diabetic himself. Yeah. I went to med school with him, and he advocates a low-carb diet for type 1 diabetics.
Yeah.
But you have to be careful with that, because then, you know, you have to really time your insulin, and
you do,
you know, make sure that you follow your blood sugar.
It really tightens the window, which is a very, very good thing. I just wrote in last week's newsletter about the administration of insulin.
Okay.
So whether it's the endogenous insulin that our pancreas makes, or the insulin that you have to administer because of type 1 diabetes, you want to keep it tight and low.
Yeah.
Overall. So the antidote is still a lower carb diet.
Because insulin is life-saving, but too much is a poison.
And a very necessary hormone.
Too much is a poison.
Exactly. It's got to be a Goldilocks again. Yes. So much is in medicine and nutrition. We want Goldilocks, not too much, not too little.
Yep.
So.
And now back to our questions. What's next, Leah?
Okay. This is from Jennifer. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I saw your article with 18 supplements for allergies. Mm-hmm. Does this apply to food allergens too?
Well, it does and it doesn't, because we're talking about seasonal allergies. You know, there are certain things that are helpful. And you don't have to take all 18 of them. I just threw out there what are some of the plausible things.
Right.
Like butterbur and things like that.
Yeah.
You know, quercetin.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's saying for GI allergens, I've read about glutamine, slippery elm, marshmallow root, DGL, quercetin. That's not allergy.
Oh, no.
It's more about...
That's like irritation.
Irritation, gastritis, GERD.
Those are soothing.
Soothing, exactly. It's not allergy related.
So, but I think for GI allergy, you know, you have to... you can, quite simply, there's studies that show that if you balance the microbiome, you can... reduce, say, milk allergy. This has actually been demonstrated with bifidobacteria.
Wow.
So, like, the children's respond better to allergy treatment for food allergies when they take bifidobacteria along with the allergy treatments for food allergy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the way they treat food allergy these days is they give, like, progressively smaller, tiny, tiny amounts of the food to reintroduce it.
Yeah.
Please don't try this at home, because if you have anaphylaxis, you don't, you want to have a medical supervision.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing it with peanut allergy and so on. So, but to normalize the microbiome actually helps to interpret the chemical messages of the foods in a way that may mitigate the severity of the allergic reaction.
Yeah.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
Things that tamp down GI allergies, well, DAO is one of them. It's diamine oxidase.
Right.
And what it does is it actually, some people, the body makes histamine as a reaction.
Yes.
Which is an important way of dealing with inflammation and dealing.
Right.
You know, it's a very important function to make histamine.
There's a role for inflammation.
But when it's runaway inflammation, the body has a way to dispose of the excess histamine. And one of the ways it breaks it down is with diamine oxidase.
Mm-hmm.
And some people genetically don't make enough diamine oxidase, and you can take it as a supplement, DAO.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pork extract.
Yeah.
So, you know, some people have a problem with that, but, you know, pork insulin too has saved lives. So, it's something that we might use to seal the gut.
Yeah.
But, you know.
And often a leaky gut is a cause of food allergies.
Yes, yes.
Jennifer, it's best to stay away from your food allergy foods, especially if you have an overreaction. But even if you were found, say, on an IgG RAS food panel, to have these kind of stealthy food allergies, what you want to do is at least eliminate them for a period of time, maybe 3 months, maybe 6 months, and then reintroduce them slowly to give your immune system a chance to calm down.
I think part of the problem with food allergies is the prevalence of chemical additives in the foods.
True.
And I think that they damage the intestinal immune system.
Yeah.
and screw up your gut and make you have leaky gut.
Right. And there's even an argument for, is it gluten intolerance or is it the glyphosate?
Right.
That's been sprayed on the wheat crop. Mm-hmm. That's causing the problem of gluten intolerance or being interpreted as, you know, all of these are causing damage to our intestines. Yep. That, GMOs, we don't know. The herbicides, the pesticides, all of the above. What damage is that causing that is causing us to be more reactive? And that's why we're seeing more and more of that. Toxic exposures. Jennifer, this is a very wonderful and thoughtful question. And thank you.
In a general way, I think you can alter your reactivity by taking omega-3 and maybe GLA because the leukotrienes, there are actually medicines that work on leukotrienes like Singulair. Mm. Well, essential fatty acids also modify the leukotrienes, which are either anti-inflammatory or pro-inflammatory.
Yeah.
And you can make more of the good ones, the protective ones, and less of the bad ones when you take omega-3s. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're like severely allergic to fish, that's a problem.
Yeah.
But most people are not. And, you know, it's more about allergies to milk or wheat or things like that.
Yeah.
And what people think are food allergies are sometimes not food allergies.
Yeah.
They just, it's an intolerance.
It's an intolerance. So, like, people think dairy allergies, you know, they drink a glass of milk and then their belly gets all gurgly and they get, that's not, it's a lactose intolerance.
It's an intolerance. And when you, there's actually, it's interesting that with, it's kind of a use it or lose it thing with that, is most people have this gene, which is the lactase secreting gene.
Yeah.
That they, which means that at a certain age, they lose the ability to digest milk.
Yeah.
Because in most cultures, you know, you drank mother's milk and then you didn't drink milk.
Right.
And prior to the introduction of dairy domestication.
Yeah.
What were you going to do? Track down like a female mastodon and like, you know, tackle her and like suckle at her, you know, at her, teats, you know.
Wet nurses?
No. No, but that would, did not happen. So we weren't consuming dairy, but then we developed as an option, a gene that enabled us to persist in adulthood in tolerating dairy. And most of those people come from like the Nordic area, Scandinavia, or parts of Africa or Asia where there was domestication of animals. So in China, it's kind of different because in the north of China, the people have less lactose intolerance than in the south of China.
More
subtropical parts.
Yeah.
So genetically, some people have that, but it's a use it or lose it thing. You can sometimes reintroduce small amounts gradually and you regain a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take bifidobacteria, that also helps you to regain a little bit lactose digestion.
And it's what you don't use, you lose, just like our muscles.
Yeah.
You can cause your own lactose intolerance by being completely dairy-free for several months. And then you may find with that first glass of milk, it's not going down too well.
For me,
because your lactase enzymes have been asleep.
Yeah, for me, it's New England clam chowder.
Yeah.
It just kind of runs through me. I can have, you know, if somebody says, here, have like a scoop of ice cream. I'll tolerate it.
Yeah.
But I have that gene.
Right. Okay. So there we go. Okay.
It's not an allergy.
It's not an allergy.
We could do a whole treatise on the different ways that people can react negatively to food.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Actually, that's going to be the topic of my next podcast. You know, differentiate a little bit about idiosyncratic reactions versus intolerance versus true allergy, which is immune mediated and so forth. And some of that and the various testing.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many ways that you can react to different substances in food.
That's true.
Or the physical properties of the food. Like some people don't do well with raw. We had a patient just now that I talked to who, she can't eat a salad. She doesn't do well with raw. But she eats a lot of vegetables.
Yeah.
I mean, she eats a ton of vegetables. In fact,
she's a very good eater.
So many vegetables, she's a little yellow in her skin.
She eats a lot of carrots.
I told her about
that. Yeah. Okay. All right. We've got a question here from Lee Chai.
Okay.
Let's see here. I have a friend who has a constellation of symptoms that don't appear to be related to Crohn's disease, but this was the diagnosis he received.
Well, Crohn's disease is not just a symptomatic diagnosis. It's an anatomical diagnosis. They would have to have seen Crohn's disease on a colonoscopy.
Yeah.
Or on sometimes in the small intestine, there are other ways. Colonoscopies don't get into the small intestine very well.
Mm.
So, you know, maybe via imaging or somehow.
Right. So
and
these
blood,
symptoms.
Blood tests. And,
right. Absolutely. The symptoms include lower abdominal pain and soreness within an hour after meals.
That could be Crohn's.
That could be that. Cold fingertips and fatigue, exercise intolerance.
Well, there's people who have IBD have extra intestinal manifestations.
True.
In other words, they have systemic effects of that condition.
Yeah. Extremely low iron and anemia. First of all, that's a reason to have cold fingers, to be extremely tired, and possibly as a result of Crohn's, ulcerations and things.
But there could be like some autoimmune thing going on with the hands, you know, like a Raynaud's disease.
Now, he also says endoscopy and MRIs don't show any abnormalities. Hmm. But what about a colonoscopy? You say endoscopy and MRI. Would it show on an MRI?
Well, it could show on an MRI,
okay. No signs of bleeding.
So
bloody
how do they
stools?
Get a diagnosis of Crohn's disease? I'm not on web based. I mean, there's anti-saccharomyces antibodies, which is somewhat of a blood test that determines Crohn's disease.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
It's baffling we don't think the current diagnosis and associated prescription drugs for Crohn's is making any difference. It's probably misdiagnosed.
I don't know. I mean, I can't opine on a case where I don't know the details.
Right.
But it's to put people on Crohn's drugs that are really powerful, presumptively, I don't understand that. I'm not saying it's a mistake. I just don't understand how that happened without clear-cut evidence of Crohn's disease. There must have been some indication that Crohn's disease was a diagnosis, because the concern would be, are we treating just IBS with powerful immunosuppressive drugs?
Mm.
You know, there's a lot of people who have a lot of distress. They don't have Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis.
No, they don't
have
any
ton of distress. The drugs used for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease would be useless.
Yeah. Wow. P.S. has had a few events of what was thought of bowel obstruction, where he experienced extreme pain and dehydration.
Well,
we don't know what brings him on, and after receiving some fluids, sometimes antibiotics, they resolve. Oh, diverticulitis?
I know.
Don't know. Li Chai, we don't know.
Is it possible? I mean, doesn't it sound like American style medicine? Is Li Chai in China or something like that? I don't know.
Don't know. Yeah. But it's a Gmail account nonetheless.
Well, I guess they can have Gmail accounts.
Sure. Absolutely.
Google being there. I don't know.
Hard to say. Needs more thorough investigation. Okay. Well, thank you for your email and best of luck to your friends. This is from Susan. Been reading more and more about cancers popping up in healthy young adults.
Turbo cancer.
Yeah. There are numerous MDs who seem well-credentialed who are really convinced the vax is involved. What are your thoughts?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, they're the people who say the vaccine is a great boon to mankind and the side effects are rare and minimal. And on the other hand, there are people who basically are saying, you took the vax, you're going to die. And they're creating a great deal of distress and alarmism.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
And there's, I think, I don't always try to be in the middle, you know, because I think an excess of moderation is not good.
Right.
You know, I want to be decisive on issues and controversies. But I have to see some more real compelling evidence that we're seeing enough.
We need to see more data.
There's no question.
Turbo cancers.
We're seeing an alarming increase in cancers in young people. There's no question. So something's happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear.
I want to throw something out there.
But it was happening before the vaccine.
It was. It's true.
Yeah.
What about overdiagnosis?
Okay. No, I mean, I think that there is more screening.
Yeah.
And cancers are being found earlier.
Right.
But this does not merit the designation of these as turbo cancers.
Because,
you know, I've actually heard stories of people I actually visited a colleague, and she said, "Oh, you know," I said, "Well, why don't you travel anymore?" She said, "Oh, I lost my travel companion."
Oh.
She was 56 years old, and she was fine, but then she was diagnosed with the sarcoma, and she was dead within 6 weeks. And you know, that's kind of a turbo cancer,
yeah.
You know. And what caused that? You know, who knows what that is? Is this? You know, there's so many things wrong with our environment that it's hard to pinpoint. You know, is it diet? Is it chemicals? Is it, you know, EMFs? Is it
all of the above?
You know, and it could be like a synergy of all these things. Could vaccines be in some ways undermining our natural immune surveillance against cancer? That I believe is worth investigating. Is the COVID vaccine per se a cause of cancer? I don't know. I mean, there's some doctors out there who are kind of firebrands, and they're making inflammatory statements.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm open to the evidence.
Yeah.
But it's like, show me
right.
The evidence.
Right. Right. See the data.
I just don't think it's that, you know.
It may be too soon to tell. It was only three years ago.
I don't think that information should be suppressed. I also don't think it's that great to broadcast that kind of message.
Yeah.
Because it scares people. You know, I don't want to be someone who makes everybody who's taken the vaccine think that they're doomed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's what essentially some people at the fringe are saying, is that we're going to be in a zombie apocalypse and the only survivors are going to be the refuseniks.
Well, you know, even pre-pandemic, I agree with you, Dr. Hoffman. We've been seeing more an incidence of cancers. Yeah. So one case report comes to mind. It was an email that we had gotten from a woman who had breast cancer. It was an overstain on a biopsy.
Oh, and it turned out not to be.
And it turned out not to be, but she already had
a mastectomy.
The mastectomy and the reconstruction, and it was all a mess because the nipple was inverted or some horrible.
Yeah.
She was butchered.
Right. And that's actually, that's an argument that can be made against surveillance. So our main surveillance tests are cervical cancer testing.
Yeah.
And I think that's merited because it actually has been shown to save lives. Colonoscopy, a little bit less, but the downside of colonoscopy isn't too terrible. Getting mammograms will do some damage because they're unnecessary biopsies, unnecessary worry. And, you know, we are detecting it earlier, but maybe we're curing cancers that wouldn't have made a difference anyway, you know, either or. You know, we're detecting cancers that
would have taken care of themselves.
Yeah, but there's some evidence of that. So,
right.
So, you know, there's this argument that I've done some themes on this on my show of, you know, overdiagnosis and our rush to detect things early. And one of the things I worry about is they are coming up with blood tests for cancer, and they're getting better, but they're not.
Are these a Galleri 100%. Tests?
Like a Galleri test,
okay.
Yeah. And so just like we test for cholesterol, maybe every year we should do the Galleri test on people. But the problem is that a test even that's 99% accurate still will turn up a lot of false positives. And then you're going to go on a wild goose chase and you're going to subject people to a lot of unnecessary
testing.
And they're actually doing a trial in England, a limited trial. They're picking a few thousand people, and they're going to do like sequential Galleri tests on them, paid for by the National Health Service. So, you know, government subsidized Galleri tests, and they want to see if it's going to actually make a difference. Cause that's an open question we have the ability to detect cancer early, but will it make a difference?
That's a great question.
Now, it would be one thing if we had those tests and they're pretty accurate. And we had very effective cancer treatments that were like really, we had the answer.
We're making the cancer go away. Bang.
All we have to do is detect it and we'll make it go away.
Yeah.
But we're not there yet. So then the question is, the utility of the test is less in the face of cancers where, I mean, we're making progress, but there's still a lot of people dying of cancer because therapies are not vanquishing it.
Yeah. A lot of work to do in this area. Susan, thank you for your email.
And I would love to see a test that is valid. You know, I got a call mm-hmm. this many years ago. There was a proposed cancer test. It was the right idea. It was called the AMAS test. Came up, you know, it was something that was introduced at a medical conference that I went to. And I thought about using it, but then I said, I don't know if it's ready for prime time. I was very excited about it, you know, because it was purported to diagnose cancer. And I got a call from a colleague, and he was a younger physician. And he, you know, I guess he called me because he needed advice. And he said, look, he says, I got a situation. He says, I have a patient who has schizophrenia. And I did the AMAS test mm-hmm. on this patient, and it's positive. And I have done every conceivable test to find the cancer that this test says this patient has, and I can't find the cancer. And the patient is schizophrenic and is freaking out.
Oh, boy.
Because I've told the patient the result of the test.
Yeah.
And the patient doesn't have the wherewithal to cope with the nuances and the ambiguity of a situation where a test could be a false negative.
Yeah.
And, or maybe the cancer is so small we can't find it. And so it's like a time bomb.
Yeah.
The person believes their body is a time bomb ready to explode.
Oftentimes this can become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's something. This is interesting because Cheryl Atkinson brought this up in regard to COVID, and it was a little bit of a surprising turn of the conversation. She said one of the worst aspects of COVID was that they made us feel it was so deadly in the beginning, and that so many people were dying, and the they didn't have enough capacity to fill the trucks up with the corpses, and so she said, did it possibly have a psychological effect on the people who came down with COVID? That they felt like, oh my God, I've got COVID, or the test is positive, I'm going to die. And that can actually be, and I, you know, from a medical standpoint, it's like hard to imagine that something psychological could kill you, but it certainly...
Sure can. If you've been pinned with a diagnosis, diagnosis will...
It's called a nocebo effect. It's the opposite of a placebo.
Yeah.
And so it's like if the doctor tells you, you've got a cancer that's fatal.
And not only that, you have 6 months to live.
Right.
So now a bone has been pointed at you.
Yeah.
Say you've got only six. Guess what? You'll probably die in 6 months.
Right.
If you believe that.
It's a tough position for a doctor because on the one hand, you don't want to sugarcoat it.
No.
You do want to give a patient actionable information. They have a cancer that is very likely to kill
them.
And
a lot of patients really want to know because they want to know how much time they have.
But, you know, it's really strange. I mean, I've got a colleague. He's actually just a Facebook friend, and he's a cyclist. And I've never met him, but I feel like I know him. And he's had a cancer struggle. He was diagnosed with a potentially fatal cancer 23 years ago.
Hmm.
And he, you know, he's also a triathlete. I've seen his exploits, and he's debilitated now because of the treatments he's gotten. And he was circling the drain a few months ago. And it was basically, he was kind of saying his farewells. And he got an opportunity to get a therapy that's an experimental therapy that was only, he had like a 20% chance of it being effective. And it wasn't even tried on his cancer.
Uh-huh.
It was tried on, I think, melanoma, but he didn't have a melanoma. He had a sarcoma. And he's responded to that. And he's back out there cycling and running. But look, he knows that his time is likely limited.
Yeah.
But he also has a will to live, and he's really doing a lot of great stuff in the time that's allotted to him. And, you know, it's hard to predict. It's hard to predict. And, you know, even without, you know, some kind of definitive treatment, sometimes people really exceed their life expectancy with fatal diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So for doctors, it's hard to kind of have the balance between realism and like, doc, tell me really, truly what's going on. It's statistical. You can say, look, here's your cancer. Here's your stage. Typically people, have a 5-year survival of 30% with this cancer.
Yeah.
Well, that means that you know, you're likely to die within 5 years,
mm-hmm.
but you also have a 30% chance of not dying. You know?
Not
so it's pretty bad.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't think there's any such thing as a cancer that is uniformly zero five-year survival.
Yeah.
There, some cancers are pretty close to that.
Mm-hmm.
But some people can grab the ring and
mm-hmm. Wow.
And especially now, with I think there's a dawning of a new era in cancer treatment where, look, a lot of these therapies just don't pan out, and they're super expensive, and they cause a lot of side effects, and I've written about this. And
mm-hmm.
like, I, you know,
it's not adding to quality of life.
Yeah,
you're going to live 2 months more and be sick as a dog.
But you don't know. You know, sometimes it could work. It's a very challenging time in cancer treatment.
Yeah.
So anyway.
Okay.
That being said, on that cheerful note.
On that cheerful note, just to remind everybody, questions@drhoffman.net. Questions@drhoffman.net.
And let's hope that there's no cosmic events, no earthquakes, no cicadas are coming.
Oh, cicadas, I don't mind.
Cicadas are coming. But it's like a biblical plague. It's like earthquakes, cicadas.
We had cicadas
eclipses.
Years ago. I love that.
Is the Hudson River going to run bloody red next? You know,
we're in New York.
It's true. Yeah. Every day we get a dispensation from doom and destruction. We're like,
it's true.
We have a target on our backs in New York.
Honestly.
Okay.
Gotta look both ways and behind you.
So,
okay.
God willing, we'll be back next week with another edition.
Yeah. Thanks, Dr. Hoffman. Thank you, everybody.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Questions@drhoffman.net, the destination for questions, 877-726-8255 during our radio program on Saturdays or anytime during the week to record a question. A lot of ways to get questions to us, and we'll be responsive. Thanks for listening. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Thanks, Layla.
Thanks.
I want to thank you for listening to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or your favorite podcast app, and get new episodes automatically downloaded every weekday. And please give us a rating and review. It truly helps new people discover Intelligent Medicine. The Intelligent Medicine Podcast is for general informational purposes only and does not constitute the practice of medicine, nursing, or other professional healthcare services, including the giving of medical advice, and no doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of information on this podcast or materials linked from this podcast is at the user's own risk. The content of this podcast is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Users should not disregard or delay in obtaining medical advice for any medical condition they may have and should seek the assistance of their healthcare professionals for any such conditions. Finally, please visit drhoffman.com and discover everything Intelligent Medicine has to offer, including frequently updated, unbiased health news, and fully vetted product and supplement recommendations.
This is Layla Mutin, RD. I see patients regularly, along with Dr. Hoffman. If you require a nutrition consult with me but live out of town, there's no need to travel to New York City. I have telephone consultations with clients from all over the country. Please visit drhoffman.com for more information. And to set up an appointment, call 212-779-1744. That's 212-779-1744. I look forward to being a collaborator in your healthcare.